real-time check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And here we are in the Allstate Showcase Studio. Welcome to Monday afternoon, everyone. A little bit later in the program, there's something interesting going on in Vietnam where they are looking to create a Facebook etiquette, a social media etiquette, sort of. That's one way to read it. But then on the other hand, they're throwing people in prison who criticize the government from Facebook. So is it an idea to make everyone more civil, or is it actually crackdown on dissent? We'll kick that around a little bit later in the program with Jim Jaworski, a digital news editor at the Tribune. But we start on Mondays with the folks from Chicago Inno. Jim Dahlke is in the studio. Catherine Davis here as well. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Steve.
Hey, Steve.
And not long before we got started here, news broke from Netflix that they have hired a new production company, which is amazing to me. The production company is going to be called Higher Ground Productions, and the people behind it are Michelle and Barack Obama.
That's right. What a score for Netflix, huh?
Wow, I guess so, as long as the shows are good.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, so this is a multi-year deal just announced today, and it sounds like it's pretty broad in terms of like what kind of content the Obamas can kind of produce. It sounds like they'll be doing anything from scripted series, unscripted series, docu-series, documentaries, features. I'm sort of surprised they didn't add in improv comedy or
there's no
reality.
Anime.
Yeah, like, exactly.
No, everything
right?
But anime. Go ahead.
So what's so fascinating to me about this is that, the Obamas probably could have had only a handful of other options, right? Whether they could have gone to Amazon, probably they could have done this at HBO. But Netflix really is the sort of powerhouse platform to where they can kind of give, you know, someone like Barack and Michelle Obama the ability to kind of do a range of different shows.
120 million viewers, I think, 90 countries around the world. And they've made a real commitment this year, I think. Is it 70% of their programming, something like that, is going to be on original programming? So they are doing just like this, they're doing with so many different production companies.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that, you know, throughout his presidency, Obama has met a ton of, you know, really interesting people doing cool things out there. So I'm sure that they have no shortage of content or, you know, people to highlight.
It'll be interesting to see what kind of programs they produce because they are a couple who might greenlight some things that other people might not.
Exactly. And the Times kind of words it in their piece today that it's not going to necessarily be like overtly political. It's not going to be like a rebuke to the current president, right? So it sounds like they're going to kind of cover a range of different issues. But it's interesting too, right? So, you know, President Trump sort of began as this television celebrity turned politician. Now Obama, politician sort of turned, media mogul.
Yeah, I think they'll probably find stories of people making a difference, minority stories, things like that. And, well, it's exciting, I think. We'll see what happens.
Definitely.
Okay, so that's great. But I have to pay full price for my Netflix. Catherine wrote about a story that's going to change the way I buy everything for the rest of my life. It's called Wish Your Price.
Yep.
And they're not quite up and running yet, but I'm ready.
Yeah. So they are a Chicago startup, and what they've done is they've built a technology that lets consumers basically haggle with online retailers. So they sell this technology, this software, to retailers. They integrate it onto their websites, and when customers come and want to buy something, they can be like, hey, I don't want to pay $50 for this. How about $35? And the software will immediately give them an answer.
So I'm buying a big screen TV, and I go to the big screen TV store, and they're selling it for $2,000. And with this software, if they have it, I can say I want to pay $1,800.
Yes.
And they can say yes or no, right? If they say no, I can say I want to pay $1,850. So you are haggling with, well, I think Jim, you said off the air, you're haggling with the computer, but the retailer set a price, and then if you get above it, you get a discount.
Yeah, really, the startup is basically letting you haggle with robots online. And you know, it's not that unlike, you know, a retailer says, okay, we're willing to give up to 15% off on a certain item in our store. And so what it does let you do is kind of give you that, it's a very rewarding feeling, you know, when you say you go into a flea market and you see something for $30
right.
And you get it for $15, right? And you can walk away and you got a deal.
Watch this. Yeah. And you get
exactly.
You get 75 cents
and
off.
And this is letting you do this with kind of more mainstream retailers.
Okay, but so it doesn't cost the consumer anything. So this to me could be revolutionary if it catches on. I guess the key is getting retailers to buy in. If they don't go along, you can't use it. But if they do, why would you not go to the big screen TV store that's offering you a potential discount. I mean, why ever pay full price again? Was that sort of like a slogan?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a really good marketing tactic for retailers. You know, plus this startup also offers the companies they work with like smart trigger emails, which is basically just, you know, marketing directly in customers' inboxes. And then exit detection, which is so, you know, if you don't want to pay $2,000 for that TV and you're about to exit out of the web page, this will be like, hey, why don't you wish your price first and see what happens?
All right, we got to take a break, but tell me about this Honey app too that is up and running now.
Yeah, so Honey is a browser extension. They're a California-based startup, and you know, when you're checking out on Amazon, they will automatically scan the internet for those coupons
you have a production code or a promotion code. They'll find it for you.
To me, that's almost the better idea, right? Like, because it automatically gets you the lowest price that's been offered online, right? So it sort of does the hunting for
you. And that's
you.
Up and running now, right?
Yes.
All right, we're going to take a break, come back, and we're going to take an Uber ride together.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It's 12:23. Catherine Davis and Jim Dahlke are here from Chicago Inno. Okay, so Uber has started with this new Uber Express in the city, right? Catherine, what is that?
Yeah, so basically it's supposed to be a more efficient and simpler version of Uber Pool. So riders will be picked up in one place and then dropped off in another one place, mm-hmm. that is, you know, presumably close to all of their destinations.
So there's a designated spot where they pick you up, and then there's a designated spot where they drop you off.
Yes, right? Instead of going from like each, you know, pickup location.
Right. I'm picturing the board meeting at the CTA, and they're saying that's what we do.
It is. It does sound very similar to a bus service, but it's not exactly the same. So bus obviously has fixed routes. Uber is kind of making smart routes. So it's not necessarily that everybody go to this place. It's creating better pickup locations for the driver. So basically the idea is that the driver's picking people up along a straight line rather than having to kind of zig and zag out through sort of side streets and back alleys. So the idea is that Uber Pool is kind of trickier for drivers because it's not very efficient. This is supposed to make drivers make trips more quickly, get them more money, and it overall cheaper for riders.
And right. And with the CTA, obviously you're making a lot of stops, so you're not making it an Uber Express. Is it up and running now?
It is. Yeah. So they did the kind of beta test at the end of last year in Boston and San Francisco, and they've slowly been rolling it out to more cities throughout the year.
We've been talking about Coinbase and their decision that they're a cryptocurrency company, and they announced a while ago that they were going to come to Chicago. And I might have been talking to the three of us about this. Maybe it was someone else, but about that. Well, they'll probably start with a sales staff. And you're up with a story that says they're not starting with a sales staff at all.
Right. They are not doing sales at all. They're doing engineering. So that's what's so fascinating about the Coinbase office is that they plan to hire 100 engineers over the next 3 years. 90% of the office is going to be developers.
Which is much different than a way a company normally comes in.
Right. Most Silicon Valley companies see Chicago as the perfect place to build their first major sales outpost, right? And for obvious reasons. And so we don't see a lot of Valley companies kind of building out huge engineering forces in Chicago. And Coinbase is sort of doing the exact opposite.
And it's sort of like they're going to where the money is, right? I mean, it's just the opposite. They're going where the talent is and where the money maybe isn't as great.
A lot of trading talent in Chicago, a lot of trading firms in this area, they see Chicago as kind of the ideal destination to kind of tap into a lot of that talent. So Coinbase, you know, a high growth, very heavily venture-backed company is certainly attractive to a lot of developers.
And one more story I want to talk about. Catherine, you went to visit a lot of the folks who have been on Shark Tank. Mm-hmm. From Chicago, and sort of talk to them about what their experience was. Overall positive, right? I mean, how could it be? Well, almost overall completely positive.
Yeah, absolutely. I spoke to about 8 Chicago startups that have appeared on Shark Tank, and you know, the major takeaways were that, you know, the exposure is really great. A ton of these companies saw, you know, increases in revenue, increases in sale, and whatever they're making. And then, you know, one other interesting thing is that not every deal you see on the show actually closes in real life. You know, after the camera shut off and you start negotiating terms of the deal, sometimes it falls apart.
Maybe they're better off. I've had the guys from Spikeball in, and their deal did not get consummated or completed. But that's okay because they got the exposure and they took off on their own.
Exactly. And, you know, the sharks on Shark Tank are often kind of trying to take a huge cut of the business. And that's not necessarily the best plan for every company, right? Especially when you're early stage and you've got the potential to grow to the level of Spikeball. I'm sure the Spikeball guys are thrilled that they didn't take that deal. So they now they own more of their company.
And so the question then is, who are the sharks? Are the sharks the Mark Cubans who are offering the money and trying to take control? Or are the sharks these companies that once they get in the pool are dancing with them and then not taking the deal at all and just building off the publicity?
Everybody is kind of using everybody a little bit, right? But I mean, there's certainly something to be said for, you know, connecting with someone like Mark Cuban, right? If you are a super early stage business, you want to get your product in front of more eyeballs, there are few people to do that better than Mark Cuban, right? So I don't think that I take a super cynical view of it. There are certainly match made in heaven, right? So I think that it certainly can be beneficial for both the investor and the company.
Jim Dahlke, Catherine Davis, read more at ChicagoInno.com. And there's the Inno Minute every morning.
5:25.
On the opening bell.
That's right.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
All right, very excited about this. We've been talking to the finalists of the James Tyree Award. You know, they're going to make the award coming up, the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce, at their annual meeting on June 5th. And the second of the three finalists in the studio now, the name of the company is Ink Factory, and in the studio is Dusty Fulwarsny and Lindsay Wilson. How did I do, ladies?
You perfect. Did
okay,
great.
So that was the hardest part, right?
That was.
Coming up and remembering the name and everything. I am so fascinated with what you guys do. You create a visual record of a meeting, right? So let's say we're having a board meeting. One of you or an artist who works for you is sitting there drawing as people have the meeting, and at the end of the meeting, they have what?
They have a physical representation, a physical archive of how the conversation unfolded. And that representation can look like, can be as small as a piece of paper all the way up to we've done representations that have been 8 feet tall and 48 feet wide.
And so when they have this visual representation at the end, is this something to remind people of what they talked about, or is it to inform other people of what they talked about?
It's both. So since the people in the audience got to see the visuals unfold as they were listening to a speaker or in a brainstorm session, they get that physical archive that they can refer back to. Maybe it's a roadmap and they look at it for 3 years while they're reaching all their milestones, or maybe it's simply a reminder.
Now, these are pictures. We call them pictures, but they're mostly words.
It's a combination of both text and pictures. And so we often say to our clients and the people that see our work is content is king. Uh-huh. So we really want to represent the conversation. But we also know that visuals are easier to understand and remember. So I would say it's a 70-30 split or it's a 50-50.
But you never end up with just a sort of a still life bowl of fruit at the end of the meeting.
That's what they discuss.
Have you ever finished a drawing, a work, and then had the people look at it and say, well, that I don't feel like that was it at all?
Honestly, no.
Which could be a healthy thing because it kind of speaks to how people don't always participate in the way that they think they are.
I would often say when, again, we're involved in a lot of different kinds of conversations where it could either be a conference attended by thousands or it could be an intimate meeting attended by 7 to 10 people. And those kind of conversations allow for it to be collaborative where it's like, hey, Lindsay, actually, I want this captured this way. And so it can be iterative.
That's Lindsay. Here's Dusty. Do you draw? Are you one of the artists?
Yes. So Lindsay, Ryan, and myself co-founded Ink Factory, and we are the service providers. We do the sales. We're doing things behind the scenes, but where our passion is doing the work.
Do you ever have stage fright? I mean, it's a very public thing you're doing in a way.
So I luckily don't. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why. But as soon as I turn around, 6,000 people behind me, it's just me and the markers, and that's good enough. But I know that definitely some people do get the stage fright.
You must work to create what you're seeing, to capture what you're seeing. But in a way, you could almost become the show, too. I mean, if someone's in a room, they're watching you draw what they're saying. It could alter it in a way.
Actually, we say that even though they're watching us, they're paying attention because this is based on a methodology that more people are visual learners. So if they're able to see the content unfold visually, they're going to remember the conversation. They're going to engage with the information differently. So I'm happy for them to stare at the back of my head.
Yeah, that's kind of a thing, isn't it? So it's almost reinforced. And so who is it that hires you? What kind of clients do you sort of see repeat, or what's your biggest chunk of client?
Well, we work with everything from a local nonprofit to a foreign government and every sector in between. So we work a lot in the healthcare industry. We work a lot with financial industry, manufacturing, but also we love all of our nonprofits. The segments are pretty varied.
I keep going. I'm sorry, I'm jumping all over.
Yeah, but that's okay.
It's just my mind is racing with this because, you know, there's so many different, you know, it's like telephone tag in a way.
Sure.
There's so many different people taking things in and then, excluding them or sharing them or whatever. Mm-hmm. So in a way, your individual take becomes part of the meeting.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So there's a little pressure on you there.
There can be, and there's lots of times where the meeting requires multiple artists to capture a conversation, and what's really great is to see how each artist will capture it slightly differently.
Are they working together on one work or different work?
We do it both ways. We have tandem capture, where Dusty and I might be working on a board together, and that's magical to see. Or we could have artists staged around or in different breakout rooms.
Who do you like to work with, Dusty, better?
I am not going to answer that question.
We all work together wonderfully.
It's true.
We're talking about before the show, and it's someone said, "Well, this is like the court artist that you used to see on TV," which sounds kind of retro, right? We're all about digital and video today. So how do you make that jump?
So language evolved in pictures before we actually had a written language. So way back in the day in caves, that's what our human brain evolved to see as pictures. And so we're just naturally drawn to it. So we can kind of break through all the digital noise and people say, hey, a human created that. And they're just naturally drawn to it.
So Lindsay, when you're doing one of your drawings, do you ever draw like the loud mouth or the interrupter picture of that person in your final?
That's a great question. And I always say I never want to offend anyone in the audience. So we don't draw caricatures.
Yeah, but you might offend one, but endear yourself to 99 others.
It's true. But, our tagline is "You talk, we draw." It's awesome. And we are able to visualize any kind of conversation from your Monday strategy meeting all the way again to the multi attended conferences.
The name of the company is The Ink Factory. Website, where do people find more?
www.inkfactorystudio.com. We're located in Bucktown. We've got a studio. Check us out on social media.
Have markers, will travel.
InkFactoryStudio.com. Okay, and you are one of the finalists again for the $50,000 James Tyree Award.
We're so excited.
What would you do with the money?
Well, we're really excited. That's twofold. We met with our employees, and we decided on doing an employee enrichment fund. So our offering is a service. So we want to make sure that our creatives feel enriched, they're happy to come to work, and they can recharge. And then also,
the other one is we have created this workshop where we teach what we do. And
excellent.
Our vision is a world where
the world
where pictures are the universal language.
Well, that's why you're so good with pictures
and not words.
Sometimes.
And not
words sometimes are tongue-tied.
Yeah, we are not public speakers, but we really want to get our workshop out to the masses. So the underserved communities here in Chicago, we want to be able to teach this workshop for free and really just get this going.
Such a cool way to share. Chicagolandchamber.org. You can find more information on their annual meeting. It's June 5th when the winners will announce. Great to see you guys again.
Thank you.
I wish you the best of luck. Stay in touch. Okay, come back.
Yes, thank you so much.
WinTrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
This is the WinTrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the WinTrust Business Minute, sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. And just like that, another big ticket buyout for an iconic Chicago building. The Wrigley Building is set to be purchased by the former CEO of Morningstar, Joe Mansueto, for $255 million. It's a huge jump since the last time the building was purchased back in 2011 for just $33 million, and then being named a city landmark just a year later. And this week, Cranes shared their annual Fast 50 list for the 11th year now, focusing on impressive five-year revenue growth rates. The company revenues range from $16 million to $3.7 billion. Some of these companies you might have heard here on WGN, like Cooper's Hawk Wineries and Restaurants, Fuda, Revel Group, Paylocity, and Zebra Technologies. There's plenty to be focusing on as the summer business season gears up. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. In the studio now, Jim Jaworski is a digital news editor for the Chicago Tribune. He helps us keep track of social media. Jim, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Glad to be here.
All right, I'm fascinated by you. You gave me two stories of Vietnam that sound completely different, but they fit together very nicely, don't they?
Yeah, so Vietnam is planning a code of etiquette, is what they call it, for their social media users. And one of it says that their activities on social media should be cultural, humane, and ethical.
It's something we talk about all the time, right? The bad tweets, people behaving badly on social media. Another quote from them, these days, many Facebookers are willing to use uncultured language only to lure more reactions and comments, and that should be avoided.
Of course, and this is something that we talk about a lot, but for Vietnam, it's a little different because just recently, I believe last month, they sentenced a man to 4.5 years in jail for what they called anti-state propaganda for what he was posting on social media.
So on one hand, we've got Vietnam saying we need to be nicer to each other on social media. On the other hand, they're sort of revealing what they mean is don't criticize the government.
Right. And a lot of human rights groups have already come out against this this legislation and saying that that is exactly what is going on here, that they're really just trying to clamp down on dissidents who actually use social media quite often to plan.
Read one without the other, it's hard to argue with, you know, let's clean up and let's be nicer on social media.
Right. And it's like, yeah, it's all very glowing. And, the government, of course, says it's a great thing.
I mean, is that something then that translates to us or maybe should be a caveat to us when we talk about clamping down on social media? I mean, there is always a risk to it, I guess, or another side to it.
Right. That argument comes up quite often. And these companies are often stuck in a difficult position because they want to cooperate with the governments in the countries in which they operate, but they also want to be seen like they're promoting free speech. And that's the conflict that we have here, too, is everybody says, well, we want to cut down on abuse. We want to cut down on harmful behavior. But then where's the line where free speech?
Twitter just talked about how they're trying to clean up the bad tweets, the mean tweets, or what is it that they're doing?
So one thing they want to do is cut down on, yeah, what they say that our behaviors are distorting and distracting from the public conversation. Basically, something would trigger with an account that has not confirmed their email address, the same person signs up for multiple accounts, and when they tweet, it'd be harder for you to see their tweets naturally in your own feed.
Right, so the algorithm would sort of give them a lower approval rating. Let's say,
for
right?
Sure.
So someone who's got like 15 different Twitter handles, these are the noisemakers. These are the people who probably aren't all that reliable anyway.
Right. So you can still, and this is kind of what Twitter is doing, that you can still see it by saying click on view more replies. But of course, Twitter gets dinged a lot for the same thing, that you're just trying to suppress people's opinions.
Is there a way I could block Kylie Jenner because she's got way too much power?
Yeah. So there was a story that Kylie Jenner apparently has. A study showed that $1 million per post is what she is valued at.
Okay, so explain that for me. So every post she makes, she doesn't get paid $1 million.
Right, that's like the relative value. For example, she posts a lot about her own companies, about the things that she owns, mostly cosmetics.
And so every time she does that, it looks like... And wasn't there... Was it Snapchat or Instagram where she sort of did an anti...
Yeah, there was Snapchat, and she kind of tweeted, and it seemed very much in passing that she just doesn't use it anymore. It seems like a very casual comment that most people would make, and their valuation dropped by $1.3
billion. $1.3
billion.
I think it was the new upgrade not too long ago, right?
Yep.
She didn't like it, and it dropped
exactly.
$1.3 billion.
And a lot of people were saying they didn't like the new upgrade, and so all she did was chime in and say, right. I just don't like it as much anymore, and bam, $1.3 billion.
Jim Jaworski is a digital news editor for the Chicago Tribune and an ardent follower of Kylie Jenner. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.